Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge high atop the Harmon Househorn building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd, and his lovely co-host, Phyllis Floyd.
Hello.
Tonight's topic, it's alive. Well, hey, everybody.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, Phyllis.
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Long time no see.
Yeah. And welcome back to the old podcast era, everybody. Tonight's topic, yes, is the 1974 cult classic, It's Alive. One I've been wanting to talk about for a while, and I'm not really sure why.
Because it's bizarre?
Well, you know, I think it all goes back to that original TV spot that I remember as a kid. It stuck with me, which I just showed you a little while ago.
Yes.
And if you haven't seen this, definitely check it out. It's really creepy, or at least it was when I was a kid. I still think it's kind of creepy today.
I think I'm a little disappointed that I didn't get to see the bassinet in the movie.
Yeah.
Because that...
It's a neat little visual.
Yeah, the little TV spot is very creepy.
Yeah, I thought about making that for Monster Fest. I've got to find one of those old bassinets, just making the fake hand sticking out. Great poster for this movie, just the bassinet against a black background and that clawed hand hanging over the edge, you know?
Yeah.
That TV spot trailer is like that. It has the bassinet, and it's you see it from the back, and it's slowly turning around with this voiceover. And the voiceover has a little stinger at the end that's really creepy. And I'll put it up on the Facebook page when we're done here. But speaking of the Facebook page, hey, drop us a line, you know? Let us know if you like what we're doing here, if you want us to talk about some other movies or you want us to shut the hell up, yeah, you can drop us a line there on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page, or if you're so inclined to email us at phantasmoad@gmail.com. That is phantasmode@gmail.com.
You got it.
We'd love to hear from you. Now, back to the movie. That trailer is cool. The long trailer, the theatrical trailer, is long.
It is long. I mean, it's just kind of a bunch of disjointed scenes.
Which is good in a way. I mean, yeah. The scenes are... It shows a lot of the, I guess, action scenes in the movie, but out of order, and so it's disjointed.
Right.
From the trailer, you're not really sure what's going on, what the movie's about, which is good. I mean, I like that it doesn't give the whole movie away, like a lot of trailers
do. I mean, it's interesting that it doesn't, but at the same point, you don't really get a feeling for what exactly is this movie
about.
That's
true.
Which could work both ways for me. I might just see that and be intrigued and go, oh, I'm going to have to see that. Or I'd be like, oh, whatever. I don't care.
Yeah, and it does go on for a long time, too.
Yeah.
It drags a bit. You're like, okay, oh, more cop shooting. Oh, more cop shooting. Yeah, just the trailer. Now, the movie itself starts off kind of a slow burn, but stuff starts to happen pretty quick. But it feels like it takes a little longer because it's just such a sweet little scene. They wake up, and she says, it's time, and okay, let's get our clothes, and we'll wake the other kid and send him over to the friend's house, and we're going to go to the hospital. We're having a baby, and everything is nice.
You can't tell that anything is a rush for her at all.
It's the middle of the night, and they're very calm. Yeah, they've already had one child, so it's like, okay. We
11 years previous.
Yeah, but it's like, okay, we've done this. We know what's going on. We're just going to go to the hospital and have this baby. And they get to the hospital, and there's father's in the waiting room, and she's in the delivery room. She's having a little trouble. Yeah, so
yeah,
she said this doesn't feel
this
right.
This is different. Things are different.
And then that's when the fun starts. Now, after that, though, it keeps on going at kind of that pace.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about this. Well, you said it seems to drag a little towards the end. But thinking about it, to me, it seems like it's not that it really drags. It's just it keeps that same even keel pace throughout the whole movie.
Maybe that's what it is.
You know?
I never experienced any type of tension building, you know. At no point did I get anxious about seeing the baby creature.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few little suspense bits and a few little jump scares throughout the movie. But the movie doesn't, like, start to pick up speed like a lot of movies do. Where when stuff starts to happen or towards
the
end.
Build in the middle.
Things start to get rolling. And the action or the you know, plot, it just starts moving a lot faster. This keeps that same even keel and that same kind of moodiness throughout the whole film.
Yeah, which is kind of good and bad, I guess, in a way. I mean,
it's different.
It keeps up what it started with, but at the same point, I think that it got, I don't know if monotonous is the right word.
Yeah, well, it's almost like the end. It's like, towards okay, the, just be you're done waiting with this for, now. Yeah, you're waiting for something to start building and building to get you that to that crescendo, you know, right. Boom, and an end. And it doesn't. It just kind of goes along, and then, oh, and here we are at the end.
Yeah, and then there we are.
But it does have a bit of tension straight through the whole thing, but not peaks and valleys of it, you know, like in other movies, which is kind of weird.
Well, one thing that it does give you the feeling of is confusion and, I don't know, curiosity, I guess. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's kind of a good thing because you kind of get the sense of what the parents are feeling. You know, they're both confused. They don't really know what's happened. They don't know how this happened. Yeah. They don't know what's happening now.
Yeah, and at first the father, at the very beginning, in the hospital, he wants to sue the hospital.
Right.
For, you know, what happened to his, because they can't find his baby. And then when they find out that it's some kind of mutant and it's killed people. Oh, sorry, gave it away. then he wants to deny that it's theirs. It's like, it's not my child. It's not my child.
Yeah, well, that, like, the one of the reps or whatever from the pharmaceutical company says, wasn't that pharmaceutical company that wanted to
I think so.
The baby for
yeah,
study?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, they said something to him about, you know, that's good. You should disconnect yourself from the child. Disassociate yourself.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know what to feel for the father for a while, because at the beginning, or, you know, after the baby's born and he's killed the first few people or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, he says, I don't really know how to feel. You know, he's being bombarded by media and he's the big local celebrity or whatever because of this crazy thing that's happened. And I didn't really feel anything for him, you know?
Well,
at that point, I didn't really get a sense of that he gave a shit at all.
Yeah, well, he's not exhibiting any emotions. It's just cold, like he's numb.
Yeah, and at first I kind of chalked that up to, well, perhaps his acting is not so great in this. But later, that changes.
Yeah.
You know, but well, you see that
he was playing it is that he was just totally numb to the whole situation.
Yeah, just really monotone.
And, you know, and maybe even in shock, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, and then towards the end, though, where he was denying it the whole time, and he even tries to kill the baby at one point.
Right
there at the end, when he sees it there wounded and crying, and even though it's this hideous, deformed mutant, you know, he comes to the realization that it's a baby, and it's his baby, and he feels protective of it, and the tears just start coming, and it's not like he starts crying.
No, he's not sobbing, but he's he's saying to the baby, it's going to be okay, you should stop crying, because if you cry, they'll hear you. You know, that kind of thing. So, I don't know. It was really interesting to me that it turned around. His acting did not improve. That's not what I mean. It's just he played it so straight, so monotone in the beginning, that when it came to it in the end and you saw the emotion and you saw that he was, you know, pulling some acting chops or whatever, I was impressed.
But, you know, that's it says, though. You didn't know that he was acting.
No, that's exactly it. That's what I'm saying.
So he's an incredible actor.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. How good it was. And that I was not impressed at first, but then, you know, it really turned me around.
And then you're like, oh I see what you did there.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I was just being slow or what it was, but it really,
and you know, and you're not expecting that caliber of performance from a grindhouse, you know, drive-in picture like this.
Right.
And this isn't one of those notorious drive-in pictures. I remember, I remember seeing the trailers on TV when I was a kid. And, of course, I was as young as I was then, you know, my folks wouldn't take me to see stuff like this, being six, 7 years
PG,
old, you know.
Oh, well, 6 or 7, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was surprised it wasn't at least PG-13. Not that it was all that graphic, but I don't know, just the nature of it, I guess, kind of made me wonder. But yeah, it was only PG.
Yeah, and you know what? And you don't really see that much gore. You see a lot of blood. You don't, and you see a couple scratches on the throat, but you don't see ripped out throats or entrails,
it wasn't super
or
gory or anything.
And you don't really see the baby mutant very much.
No,
mostly
at
in
no
shadows.
Point do you get like a real full on shot. You get a little bit of the baby kind of crawling at one point where you can kind of see it from the, you know, head on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit where you just see the hands.
Yeah.
You know, there's little bits of, little clips here and there. The lighting changes. Like, you have a little bit of a spotlight right on it at one point, and it's all black everywhere else. Yeah. So there's a lot of, you know, where you really want to see the creature and you don't really get to.
Yeah. Too much. Now I saw the creature.
Did
full
you?
Frontal. Yeah. When I was a kid.
Oh.
In the pages of Famous Monsters magazine.
Uh-huh.
Oh yeah. I mean, I saw that long before I ever got a chance to see the movie.
Right.
I knew exactly what that creature looked like.
Well, that's kind of cool. I did not have that luxury.
Oh, man. Oh, I don't even need to talk about Famous Monsters right now. I'll go on and on and on. But, yeah, you know, so many movies that I didn't get to see till I was older.
Mm-hmm.
And this being one of them that I saw, got to read about. So I knew all about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew exactly what it looked like. I knew what the story was and all that. And I knew the people that worked on it, all thanks to Uncle Fari. You know, and hey, and speaking of some of the people that worked on it, yeah, you know, we can get back into the story here in a minute, but apparently the cats are going wild in the lounge tonight.
Hip cats.
Yeah. We're all hip. Hey, and speaking of hip cats, just so you know, when we're recording this, it is the birthday of one of the coolest cats ever to walk this planet today.
And who might that be, Rob?
Happy birthday, Mr. Dean Martin.
Happy birthday, Dino.
I'll drink to that. So, anyway, back to some of the people that actually worked on this film. Larry Cohen was the writer, producer, director here, and he did that to quite a few of his films, not the least of which being the two sequels.
Right.
It Lives Again and Island of the Alive.
Island
of the Alive was the third one.
You know, when I was looking up trailers and stuff, it said It's Alive 3 and never said Island of the Alive.
Yeah, It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive. Now, you know, I have both of those right on the shelf back here in the lounge. We can
watch them.
And I believe we did show them at Phantasmo.
Well, we'll have to look into that.
That would be Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion, the every other month film program, double feature cult movie show we do in Chesapeake over at the library there.
It's all free. You should come join
us. It is free. Yeah, look that up on Facebook also for info on future events. But yeah, Larry Cohen, man, he did a ton of stuff. Q, The Winged Serpent, God Told Me To, Return to Salem's Lot, The Stuff. Even, jumped into some blaxploitation there, writer, director, producer on, or at least writer, director on, Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem, which I think we've seen both of those. One of those we showed at Phantasmo, and one of them, which I think was Hell Up in Harlem maybe, was a little too rough to show. Or maybe it was Black Caesar. God, I gotta go back and watch him again now.
Interesting.
You know, which really hurts my feelings. But man, you know, he wrote and did a lot of directing and writing for TV and stuff throughout the 70s. And even as late as 2002, he wrote the movie Phone Booth, the Colin Farrell movie.
Right.
But man, you know, he was all over the place in the 70s. But these, the It's Alive movies, I think, well, maybe running a close side-by-side with Q, The Winged Serpent, and The Stuff as being his most notorious films that he's known for. You know, and hey, you know, we're talking about the baby itself. You got to mention Rick Baker. The man, the legend, Rick Baker created the baby puppet for this. And I think this was about, I don't know, his third or fourth big job in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
His first, Octoman. He built the suit with another guy, his name escapes me now, but built the suit for Octoman, which we have to watch soon.
Oh, good Lord.
It's up there on the shelf, too.
I know it is.
And, you know, and we was this close to doing that for this podcast, too.
another time, Octoman.
But, yeah, he did that, and then he worked on Schlock with John Landis, which we'll definitely do at some point, too. I was aware of this, but I had forgotten he was assistant to Dick Smith on The Exorcist. As a makeup artist, as a very young man.
Alrighty.
And then he did this, It's Alive. And of course, he went on to do second unit special effects makeup on Star Wars, and the rest is history. And Incredible Melting Man, we've talked about, so many other films.
Done tons of stuff.
And, you know, he got to be known for, you want a gorilla done in Hollywood, you go to Rick Baker. You know, that was his big, he did the most amazing, you know, gorillas and apes. Oh, man, he's just the guy. He was one of the first makeup guys that I, but you know, well, second makeup. The first one I knew the name of was Jack Pierce. Then it was Rick Baker. And then I discovered everybody else And I'm a real geek for that kind of stuff. We can go on a big tangent about makeup and special effects, but we're not.
We won't.
Now, this is interesting. What do you think of the music in this?
You know, I remember at one point thinking, this sounds a lot like...
Yeah.
And that was closer to the beginning of the movie, and I then forgot what it sounded
but
like.
But it was good, though. But it was very moody, and it brought the suspense up and the action and the intensity of
Especially
it.
Especially since this is the podcast right after... the one we did last week of Gargoyles.
Oh,
two
yeah.
2 weeks ago, where the music was very bad, in my opinion. So it definitely stood out that I liked the music a lot in this.
Well,
one.
You should.
I should.
You
Who
should.
The music for
Because Bernard Herrmann did the music for this. And if you don't know his name, you definitely know his music. He
what
worked
did
with Hitchcock
Herman?
A lot.
Ah.
And most notably, Psycho. But he did it that, like, for North by Northwest and, you know, a few other Hitchcock movies. He also did for Citizen Kane,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Day the Earth Stood Still and Taxi Driver and, you know, oh, God, tons of other things. But those are some of the bigger things that he's done that you're like, oh, well, shit, that guy. You know, that's the music, you know. Some of the most iconic music in movie history. And then he does It's Alive.
Well, alrighty then.
But the music in it was good. It wasn't cheap,
it was.
You know, schlocky drive-in music or, you know, stock music. It was actually, you know, a good, you know, good score.
Yes, indeed.
Now, well, you know, let's go ahead and I'll go and talk about, you know, a few of the people that were in this thing. The father that, you know, you were talking about and who really kind of took you by surprise with his chops there.
Mm-hmm.
John P. Ryan was his name, and he was all over the place in the 70s, all over television in the 70s. Every single cop show, I think he did one episode on. Or not. And actually, everybody that was in this was all over TV in the 70s and in quite a few movies.
Right.
You know, so I'm not going to go through all their TV credits. The father, John P. Ryan, a few of the things he did were the Five Easy Pieces, Jack Nicholson, Future World, which I think... We watched Westworld, but you didn't see Future World, right?
I did not see Future World.
Need to see that, the sequel.
Okay.
I think it's, I don't know. I can't say it's better than Westworld. It's been a long time since I've seen it. And he was also in The Right Stuff.
Hmm.
And a lot of other things. You know, I'm not going to go through this whole thing, but he's that guy. You see his face. Oh, that guy. Didn't I see him on Columbo or didn't I see him on Starsky and Hutch? Just like, yeah, you did. You know?
Yeah, I see him in It's Alive.
Yeah. And then playing his wife, Sharon Farrell. Same thing, all over TV in the 70s. She was in movies. She did a few movies, but I guess most notable to anybody that's listening to this particular podcast on cult movies, she was in The Stuntman, which I need to watch. I have not seen that in 100 years, and I can't remember if I've seen it all the way through. It's supposed to be a very good movie, and you know, some other names in it. We may even do a podcast on that at some point. She was also in Lone Wolf McQuade with Chuck Norris, which, you know, one of Chuck Norris' better films, or you know, more fun films. Chakotay's in that, you know.
Yes, indeed.
and one of my favorite Western-type character actors, L.Q. Jones, is in that. You gotta love L.Q. No, wait a minute, not L.Q. Jones, I'm sorry. Where is L.Q. Jones in that? God, it's been so long as I've seen it.
Well, he must not be one of your favorites, then.
You know, he might be R.G. Armstrong.
Hmm.
Is in that, and poor RG, by that point he couldn't see worth a damn, and but he was, God, you talk about guy who's done everything. He was Lone Wolf McQuade's boss in that, and he was also in another movie with boss in the title.
Is there a theme?
No, but you know, they call him the boss.
Boss.
Anyway, and I got a little behind the scenes story on that I'm not going to tell on the podcast. I think I've told you before. Got it from like somebody who was on the set and worked on the film too.
Right.
But anyway, getting back into it, Andrew Duggan was a guy. Is a guy in this. He plays I think his title is the professor. He was one of the guys that they signed the thing away.
Right.
And he's another guy. You're like, God, I've seen that guy in tons of stuff. Well, yeah, of course you have. He was in Like Flint. He played the president of the United States, and in Like Flint, he was in Dr. Detroit. he had his bit part in Dr. Detroit there. He was also, and this is where you'll remember him probably, Phyllis, he did an episode or two of MASH.
Ah, yes.
He was Hot Lips Houlihan's dad, Howitzer Houlihan.
Yes. as soon as you said it, it started to click. I remember now. And I did. I saw his face and was like,
yeah, I know that guy. That's the great thing about, you know, so many of these cult movies like this. And, you know, they've got people in them that you've seen before. You're like, I know that guy, or I know that girl. She was in something that I've seen before, you know. And probably a lot of things, you know, when you get down to it and you look into it. Now, a few of the other people in here, there was one guy, well, I think the pharmaceutical rep guy with the, like the, you know, the goatee with no mustache, you know?
Yeah.
Robert Emhart. And I've seen him in a bunch of stuff and I actually had to look him up because I couldn't remember anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a lot of TV in the 70s, a lot of TV, did a few movies. But most, you know, one of the things that struck me, I'm like, oh, that's, I can see him just as good as anything. The Saturday morning live action kid show from the 70s. He played Sergeant Vinton, in The Kids from Caper.
I've never seen that.
Of course not. You wouldn't have been watching TV when this was on, I don't think. Because I couldn't have been more than 7 or 8 years old, probably. Maybe 9 at the most when this was on. And it's probably not. It's probably younger than that. Wow. But yeah, The Kids from Caper was a live-action Saturday morning kids show, and where, well, the kids from Caper were all in their 20s, early 30s. These different like archetypes, you know, one was dressed one way, one was dressed in a suit, one was dressed in a sweatsuit. You know, they had distinct different looks, and they worked for some government. And it was a cheesy kids show, you know. God, I think I was just talking about this with Dimes a while back, and he's like, "Oh, you remember that?" I'm like, "Yeah, I remember that. Who are you talking to?" You know. But that's why I can see the guy just as good as anything in my head in the cop, you know, the police uniform. But somebody who kind of snuck into this film has a very small part in it, and you know the voice as you hear it. Michael Ansara. Yes, Michael Ansara, Mr. Barbara Eden, but also Kang from the Star Trek Day of the Dove episode, the Klingon Kang, but also Killer Kane from the Buck Rogers TV series as it went on, who I believe is originally played by Henry Silva, but later played by Michael Ansara. Great voice. Done a lot of voiceover work. Yeah. And, you know.
That's good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think he even, did he even do it? Yeah, I think he even did a Babylon 5 episode. But, you know, they brought him back on Next Generation playing Kang.
Oh, I do remember that.
Him and, I can say his name because anything. Squire of Gothos. Anyway, three original, the guy who played Baltar on the original Battlestar Galactica, and his name escapes me, and I feel like an idiot. Anyway, three original Klingons they brought back, but of course now they look like the new Klingons. They never, I don't know if they explained that or not, but it was cool that they brought them back, you know. But yeah, and Sara's in here, and he's probably, I don't know, maybe he wasn't the biggest name at the time, but to me, he seems like he would have been.
The biggest on this cast, you mean?
Yeah, you know. A couple of interesting things about this movie, too. It was shot at the same time that Larry Cohen was shooting Hell Up in Harlem, except he shot Hell Up in Harlem, I think, on the weekends and shot this during the week. So most of the same crew worked 7 days a week.
Oh, wow.
And this was released, a very limited release in 74 when it first came out. And it did decent business, but nothing, you know, really write home about. Warner Brothers is the company that put it out and released it, and they didn't really support it very much. They weren't really behind it. So it did okay, but they didn't push the film around in the markets too much. And this was at the time when theaters, well, when films would play regionally.
Right.
You know, they would release them to a couple theaters, like maybe, say, in the Northwest, and then it would come down, you know, down the coast. You know, and then it would go to this region in the Midwest, or it might start up in New York and come down and go and zigzag back and forth across the country. And
yeah, but
not
the point
today.
Is it doesn't get released all over the country.
Yeah, not today, where it's like, boom, you know, Avengers comes out in 700 theaters all across the country on the same day. No, it didn't play that way. And that's why, you know, back then, the day like that, you'd hear about a movie or you'd read about it and go, oh man, I got to see it. And it might be a couple months before it actually comes to your town. So this one, it was out for a little while, did okay, and then it didn't, you know, it was gone. Now, 3 years later, Warner Brothers shake up in executives, like they do, and there's, you know, all the time there. And Cohen asked them to review the film again.
Hmm.
God knows why they did. It's kind of unheard of, I guess. But they did, and somebody liked it or something. They decided to reissue it. And that's where
when it picked up.
Well, yeah, and the new ad campaign for that trailer that I like, the TV spot, that's where that came from, and the tagline. Most parents, when they're having a baby, are overjoyed, but not the Davises. They're terrified. There's only one thing wrong with the Davises, baby. It's alive. And then they're... nasty cry, and you see that clawed hand. That was the ad campaign they went with, and it took off, and it did I think it did over 7 million domestic, and wow. In 77 that was a lot of damn money. Now that'll barely pay for catering on most films. But a very effective trailer, great poster, doesn't give anything away, but it's a very stark image.
How many movies have been revisited like that?
I don't know. That'd be something really interesting to look into.
I had no idea about that particular fact until just now.
Neither did I. I thought it just came out. And but it makes sense, though, because if I was to have seen it, and I had to, that ad campaign wasn't done until 77, so I would have been about 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
In 74, I would have been 5. So I wouldn't have really remembered much on TV, I don't think.
Right.
So that, like I said, it makes sense that they did it, but I don't understand. Well, that's not the right word. I'm with you on that. How many? It's kind of fascinating. How many other movies have done that? I don't know. I haven't really heard much about that type of thing. I know one of the most famous cult movies of all time that happened to.
Well, I do too.
Yeah, and we're not talking about Listomania either. Rocky Horror did that. It was released. It was filmed in 75 and then released. I guess about the same year. And it did squat, and it bombed. And executive at Fox got the bright idea, run it on the midnight circuit in the village, in Greenwich Village in New York.
It's slightly different because that's run it on the midnight circuit. That's not what happened with this.
No, but it's a re-release. It was out of release, and they put it back into release, and it found an audience and took
off.
It's
not like it was going to be out on VHS or something, and then you could go see it in the theater. Not like now.
That, and if they didn't, think about it, if they never had re-released Rocky in 70, in 77 there, on the midnight circuit,
It faded into obscurity.
Yeah. And it's alive here. If they didn't release that in 77 and it did more business, it wouldn't be probably not as notorious as it is.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad film. It's not a great film by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not a bad film. I think I like that steady tension throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's different, like we were saying before, to where you're used to peaks and valleys,
mm-hmm.
where something builds up, and then it does have a few jump scares.
Yeah,
and it's great because they come out of nowhere because you're not built up.
Yeah, there's
suspense.
No tension building, and then it scares you.
It's just got this
happens.
Somber, moody kind of like you're waiting for something to happen, but you're not anticipating anything happening. Mm-hmm. And then you're waiting for it, but you're not expecting it. And then all of a sudden, you're like, oh, whoa. Hey, that was effective.
That came
out
of nowhere.
And so it really works, I think, in its favor by that.
Well, one thing that I found really interesting, I said earlier, I don't think we were recording at that point, though, is that they never tell you exactly how or why this baby mutated.
Yes. That's a great point.
But they do bring up every possibility you can think of in the movie some point.
Make you think about it.
Yeah, at the one point where she's in there in the labor room and they've sent dad to the waiting room. He's talking to the other dads that are all waiting, sitting in the waiting room and they're waiting. And one of the guys starts talking about, I work for a pesticide company and we created all these.
They plant the seeds in your head.
We created this pesticide and all it did is create stronger cockroaches or stronger bugs, whatever,
And those of us watching the movie go, huh?
Yeah. So then I thought, okay, well, that's it. It's going to be a pesticide that does it. And then later, they still haven't said, the baby's been born. He's already killed the doctors and the nurses and they're moving on. And then you see the pharmaceutical representatives come out and say, how long was she taking birth control?
Yeah.
For 31 months before this child was born. Well, perhaps if it's proven that she was on the medication that our pharmaceutical company produced or manufactured, then we that could be bad for us. So
and then again,
any evidence.
We went,
so,
uh-huh?
Oh, yeah, so it could be the medication.
Yeah.
And then the doctors are standing in there at one point, and she's just kind of becoming conscious again. And he asked her, have you been exposed to any multiple x-rays or any type of radiation recently? And again, you're like, oh, radiation. Yeah. It could be radiation. Uh-huh. So you've got all these possibilities. Oh, yeah, and the smog. We can't forget the smog.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, that was a big thing in the 70s.
I know.
Air pollution and stuff.
Yeah, look at the smog. So there's all these possibilities, and you think, oh, at some point they're going to say, oh, this is what really did it, you know?
And they never do. There is no resolution to the cause of it.
No, I love it. Yeah. I love it. And then, of course, at the end, the little zinger. Are you going to give it away?
Yeah, I'll give it away. I mean, if you watch it, you watch it. If you haven't watched it, you know, and you might not. But after they kill the baby and it's all said and done, and of course, the way he gets it is great.
It's awesome.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
you'll have to, and no, we're not advocating, you know, that baby killing is funny.
Of course
but
not.
You have to see it in the context of the story. It's funny.
Awesome. Yeah.
The parents are in the back of the police car, and it's like, oh, and you're like, oh, the movie's over.
Yeah.
You know, they can get on with their lives. The monster's dead.
Yeah. They can grieve and move on.
Yeah. The police captain's in the car with him, and he gets a call on the radio or his car phone, and it's like, yes, I understand. He puts the phone down and I don't know if he looks at the parents, but he just says, there was another one born in Seattle tonight. And that's how the movie ends, right there.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, I meant to find out what city this took place in, because I can't remember.
Yeah, they should have just had, you know, the end with a question mark on it.
Right.
I love when they do that. Or, not yet, the end, you know.
You thought it was over.
And we will have to watch It Lives Again to find out.
Indeed. Does it actually take place, like, right after this?
You know, I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
It's been so long since I've seen it. But I think that the pharmaceutical rep, Howard Sahulahan, I think he's in it.
Mm.
And the father, John Ryan, is in it. He's apparently goes on a quest to find these other parents that are having... Because it's not that it's an outbreak, but there's a few others that have, you know, mutant baby. And he's... on a quest to try to, you know, help them deal with it or get rid of them or whatever, you know. And I'm not sure if he's in the third one or not.
Hmm.
But we'll have to watch them both back to back one night, some popcorn, and settle into it.
Here's something.
Yeah, date night. Right on. Come on over, everybody. We're having date night. Here's something I did not know. I just found out this evening. I'm doing a little research here. In 2008, in Bulgaria, they did a remake of It's Alive.
Oh, Lordy.
With Bijou Phillips as the mother.
I don't remember who that is.
Mackenzie Phillips' sister, Papa John Phillips' other daughter,
I
do believe. If I'm wrong, we'll edit that out, but I think that's right. They named her Movie Phillips, basically. A Bijou.
Alrighty then.
You know, that's what a Bijou is. It made in Bulgaria. Now, I don't know if it was English language made in Bulgaria or if it's a Bulgarian film. I don't know if there's a big Bulgarian film industry or not, but I never heard of it, a remake of this.
Mm.
So we must seek this out now.
I suppose.
And if anybody has seen this remake, drop us a little line on the Facebook page or something and let us know about it.
I got to know.
Yeah, because I got to know. I got to see this. Now, you know, if you like this movie, It's Alive, you know, you got to see the sequels. I know I've seen them before, but it's been quite a while since I've seen them. I cannot remember if they do get substantially worse or if they're better, or if, you know, the middle one is the best, you know, if it's the empire of the It's Alive trilogy. You know, you ever
know
notice
that
how
you
that's
can
the,
really even compare, but I know what you meant.
You ever notice that how that is the gold standard? That is the term for any trilogy
that's
of movies.
True.
They always say, was that the empire of those, you know, and you don't have to say the whole title, you know,
everybody knows.
But his other films, man, The Stuff, we'll have to do that one night, too. Talk about that on the old podcast here. Hey, Garrett Morris is into stuff.
Hey, I saw a cool stuff pin the other day, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I saw that too.
Yeah, we've recently become obsessed with these enamel art pins.
Oh, yeah, the lapel pins. You know, you used to get those back in the 80s and stuff. Well, now...
There are some amazing artists out there making custom ones. Custom limited. Fantastic.
Yeah, limited runs of these things. So there may be 60 ever made or maybe just 100. And they're making some obscure, great obscure horror films and cult film related pins, and that one, The Stuff, didn't it glow in the dark too?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Oh,
cool.
Man, that was so cool. I need to get another job just to pay for the pins.
Yeah, it's an obsession. I wish I had never found them. It's your fault, by the way.
I'm sorry. Of course, like I said, Cue the Winged Serpent is another one. I cannot remember. I know I've probably seen that. I can't remember seeing it. I don't know if I want to see it. But I've always had a soft spot for It's Alive. I don't know why. I guess because it goes back to that commercial and then Famous Monsters when I was a kid seeing pictures of it. And I know from when we showed it to Phantasmo, it's got to be in It's Alive 2. There's some scene at a kid's birthday party and one of the kids unwraps a present. And he holds it right up to the camera, fills the whole screen. And it's that Dick Smith TV monster makeup kit that was always in the back of Famous Monsters that I coveted and wanted so badly when I was a kid. Of course, my parents would never order anything out of backs of magazines for me, you know, back then.
That's one of the great things about watching some of these older movies. You see all these things that you've either had or wanted as a child. We've almost
I know,
the
as
most
soon as you said that,
thing.
The most important thing in this movie, my God, the most important thing, and it's alive. And it's even on one of the menu screens, which blew my mind. But in the middle of the film where, for some reason, the police go to the school.
They've cornered the infant in the school.
Somewhere in school. Somehow they don't know where. And the father goes to the school because he feels like he needs to be the one to kill it.
No, he says he wants to show that he feels the same way the police do and that everyone else at the school does. That night that he wants the baby.
Oh yeah, so
to
people
will
get off his back basically and leave his family alone.
That's right.
Well, he goes into this one classroom, must be a kindergarten classroom, and there against the wall, lined up against the wall, are the inflatable letter people. My God, have not seen those since I was in kindergarten.
Letter people are awesome.
And instantly I knew exactly what they were. You know, oh, there's Mr. M, Mr. T, look, oh, Miss A.
Well, you know, when it was on the screen on the DVD,
yeah.
I was really confused. I was like, what the hell do letter people have to do with It's Alive? And of course, that's what it had to do with it. It's funny that they chose to put that on the splash screen. It's like, okay.
Do you know, now I say since kindergarten, I take that back. I saw them once or twice as an adult flipping through the channels, hitting PBS. Yeah, watching Little Sesame Street. Watching Little Sesame Street as an adult, of course. But yeah, before or after, there was a cartoon of the letter people.
I've never seen the cartoon of the letter people.
I can almost hear the theme in my head. Don't ask me to sing it because I can't remember all of it. It's like I eat bits and pieces, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, there was like a little animated letter people thing. And maybe they showed that to us in kindergarten. I don't remember. All I remember is having those like 2 foot tall inflatable.
Made of that wonderful plastic that I love the smell.
Like raft material, you know? And of course, the books. Or whatever, so you could learn the alphabet.
And ours, I think our classroom, not that this matters, but I think that our classroom had like a border around the top of the
and drawings on the border. Yeah. Yes, I remember that, yeah. And the last one was the It's Alive Baby. Okay, maybe I went to a rougher school than you did.
Yeah, I think of that.
Or a twisted school.
Yeah. You kind of work that into your own memory, I think.
Man, maybe I'll have to put a little thing, you know, if I find a trailer or the cartoon on YouTube, I'm gonna put it up there on the Facebook page.
I bet that no one is as excited about letter people as we are.
If you're as excited about the letter people as we are, drop us a line on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page, won't you? No, I'm serious. Let us know if you're as excited about letter people, seeing the letter people in a cult drive-in grindhouse film as we are. Speak up and say something. Drop us a message on the Facebook page and stand together and unite.
One
with
of us. One of us.
That starts with the letter O. Oh. I can't remember what O was.
I can't either.
Because they, now, I'm not going to go in and let her people. If you know, you know. If you don't, you should.
Yeah, you got to look it up. If you don't know what it is, you'll just have to look it up and see.
Man, you know, I can't think of a better way to end
than on letter people.
To end a podcast about a cult horror film than talking about the sweet, innocent letter people from kindergarten.
What is Z? What was Z? The letter Z. Do you remember?
Oh, I don't remember.
I can't remember either.
I remember M and T, and I think A and H, I remember.
Well, darn. We can't end on the letter Z because we don't remember what it was.
No.
This episode of Phantasmo After Dark was brought to you by the letter M.
That's Sesame Street.
I know, but it works.
Close enough. All right. Well, hey, that's it for this episode. And, you know what? We'll see you next time. I'm not sure what we're going to do next time. Maybe we'll have a special guest. Maybe we won't. But we're definitely going to talk about something fun.
Of course.
Till next time. See ya.
Bye.